Hello everyone, Liam here from the Early Education Show. We haven't vanished, we are still around. We made it, I think, two episodes this year before we took an unexpected break. I'm going to put my hand up for that one. I managed to fall over and fracture my ankle a bit early on in April, and the recovery has taken a bit longer. It's been a bit more frustrating than I would have liked, and it's sort of put a damper on the regular recording, and life has sort of taken over all of us, unfortunately. We didn't want to keep people hanging around too long for a new episode, and we promise we will be back with regular fortnightly episodes at some point, once we've got on top of all the madness in our lives. So with this episode, I recorded a video interview with Kath Whitty from the ACU, the Australian Catholic University, in, I think it was March, so it was before the great fracturing of the ankle, and I had a really good time. It was a really, felt very privileged to be asked to record a video with Kath to show to her students, talking about a whole range of things about the sector. And these were students that were planning to, you know, potentially maybe start a career in early education. We covered a whole range of different topics, and I was allowed to just ramble on and on and on, as I do on this podcast. With really kind permission of ACU and Kath, they've allowed me to share the audio of that interview. So this means with a minimum of work and editing from me, we can get an episode out. So it is just me, no Leanne and Lisa. Sorry, everyone. But I hope you enjoy this sort of 45-minute just rambling about everything in early education. Like I said, I really appreciate the opportunity, and, you know, hope you find it valuable.
Hi, everyone. I'm Catherine Whitty, your lecturer for this unit, and today I'm talking to Liam McNicholas, who's the Executive Director of Northside Community Services. We're going to have a comfy chat today about a few important aspects of working in the field, and I have some questions, and I think we feel fairly well prepared. But before we start, I'd like to acknowledge that we're meeting here on wonderful Ngunnawal land, and pay my respects to elders past and present. And yes, Yuma, hello,
Yuma
in Ngunnawal. So Liam, I'd like to think that maybe a bit of context and background is a good place to start. So I wanted to ask you if you wouldn't mind sharing with our students some of your own unique trajectory into the early childhood field, and if you could focus a little bit on what inspired you, what drives you every day, and what sustained you in this important and ever-evolving profession.
Sure. Well, in many ways, the trajectory is actually pretty straightforward. It's not too different from other people. So I was working in early childhood centre, certificate 3, then diploma, then early childhood teaching degree. But before I did all that, I was studying a comms and media degree and sort of enjoying that. But in order to, as with, you know, students, in order to subsidise trips to the uni bar and those kind of things, I needed a part-time job, and yeah, there was an early childhood centre just down the road from where I lived. I'd always sort of enjoyed being with children and done a bit of, you know, babysitting and all those kinds of things. But so I was working at a not-for-profit early childhood centre while studying my degree, and I think within about 3 months I realised I'd made a hideous mistake and had ditched the comms and marketing degree and was working full-time at the centre and studying my certificate 3 in early education or children's services, as it would have been then. I think the reason for that decision, it seems like a very long time ago now, Kath, but I think it was just this really quick understanding of the impact you were able to have, particularly in the first 5 years, and I'll say particularly working with children who had maybe experienced, you know, complexity and trauma and disadvantage in their life. We were able to see really quickly what an amazing space an early education space is for those children. And that was just really, and that stayed with me for that whole time to this day. The capacity of early education, that work in the first 5 years to change trajectories and really change lives, it is like no other sector.
Yes.
So, you know, there's the capacity to make a difference, the capacity to, you know, to engage in play with children. And I'll also say, you know, the amazing people you get to work with. We're really lucky in Australia's early education sector that it's so diverse, so many people from different backgrounds. There are people and ways of living and being that I would never have known as a very boring, white bloke walking on the street that I just would never have known if I hadn't worked in the sector.
So you become a better, well-rounded human, you think, from the work.
And I hope
so. Driven by that passion.
I hope so. I don't know. I'm probably not the one to judge, but I feel like I would. Yes. Yep.
So it's fair to say that you've, from that long trajectory, arrived at quite a powerful place as the executive director for a smallish, but still very diverse not-for-profit organisation in Northside Community Services. And can you say a little bit more, so we know, you've mentioned how you qualified, but what your roles are now in that organisation?
Sure. So, because I don't teach directly with children anymore, and in many ways that's a shame. We need more people working directly with children, so I do think about that a lot. So. So I'm one of the executive directors at Northside, and I primarily oversee communications and advocacy. So a lot of our advocacy campaigns, so this year particularly the Voice to Parliament, we're spending a lot of time on, but also how we communicate with, firstly, our team. I think for a lot of organisations, even not-for-profits, communications people think of as being external. So it's about how we market or how we, increase our service provision and how we do all that kind of stuff, whereas actually I'm far more interested in how we talk to our team. So at Northside, 80% of our team are not sitting in an office in front of a computer like I am. They're working directly with children, or in our aged care programs, they're in people's homes supporting them to live independently in the home. How we communicate to people, primarily people with English as a second language, and primarily women. Because what we know about the sector is that it is overwhelmingly dominated by women. Mm-hmm. And that's something that has been a huge part of my career as well. So I'm really aware that in a sector that's 96% women, I'm in a leadership role in the sector, where I identify as a man. And so that it challenges me almost every day, where I think, that's a position that comes with a huge amount of privilege. And it's not uncommon for that trajectory to be seen. So I'm talking with students, so I can quote some research, of course. So Jennifer Sumption, I don't know if people have read much of her amazing work
on leadership.
She's also done some really interesting stuff on gender in the sector.
Yes.
And she talks about what's called the glass escalator effect.
Yep.
So whereas women face a glass ceiling, men often face a glass escalator, which is because they're seen as kind of unique in the sector, and there's often this view of, what an amazing person to work in the sector. Men are remembered in meetings far more. I know that my voice is heard far more than other people. What that means is they can shoot up the leadership ladder, and I absolutely know that's happened to me, and that's because of my gender, and that's something I find really challenging. And, the choice becomes, do you take on or not take on leadership roles? The choice I've made is to take them on, but we're always with, the only way I can do that is means I can use my voice for advocacy, in particular advocacy for the gender inequality of the early education sector. In particular, we know that it is one of the most underpaid and undervalued sectors in the workforce, and it is because of gender. It is because women do this work.
I think the difference, though, Liam, is here you are at the bottom of the escalator with me on the ground talking to students who are going into the ground, going to the coal face. The fact that you're able to articulate a critical kind of a view of it, I think, is what makes a difference between the men we want, the feminists on the escalator, who are, I think, besides women, next and alongside to them making those changes too. I know those roles that you've had have been many, and that mainly your organisation, it has four early childhood centres, is that right?
We have five.
Five,
yes.
Now.
Yep, yep.
You run as one of them.
That's right. We have a dedicated centre for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children, which is, one of the privileges of my career has been to be part of that centre. Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. And I understand, I don't think this is gossip, that you have all of your centres in terms of the national quality standards kind of meeting a high, what's the highest ranking?
That's right, so four of our five centres are exceeding the national quality standard.
Yep.
One is meeting. We are desperate for it to be re-rated because it was done a very long time ago. We're pretty sure it would be exceeding as well.
Yeah, yep. That's good. So congrats. It's really, really good to know. And it's no mean feat to hop on board with the compliance regulation.
No.
I'm sure you have a lot to say about how that impact.
Oh, of course, yes. I mean, the only thing I'd say about that is it's very little to do with me, but those are the ratings. So full credit to, to the incredible centre directors and teams
and
in those centres
staff.
Who do that work.
Yeah, it starts
every single
with those.
Day. Oh, it starts and finishes.
Interactions. Given that you have such high quality in the services, and you can talk about it and lay claim to it or not, can you tell me and the students what you think makes up quality? I know it's a very hotly contested, and I put it in inverted commas, concept.
A nice easy question.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think. It is a really difficult question to answer quickly. What I would say is I always go back to the National Quality Framework. And now, as with everything, it was developed by academics, but bureaucrats as well. As with everything, it's developed by humans. It's imperfect.
Yep.
But it is a national standard. And there's a few really important things if we go right back to the principles of the National Quality Framework, which talk about the principles of continuous improvement embedding play-based approaches to early education. But the NQF is designed not as a checklist, but that the acknowledgement that every centre can reach quality in a different way, that every centre should reflect the community, firstly of children and educators, and then families that are part of that centre, but then the broader community about, the suburb and the city and the state and everything you're in. So what quality looks like in, far north, rural Queensland will look very different to how it looks here in, very privileged with hidden disadvantaged Canberra. I guess the first thing I would say is don't try and seek very simple answers to that question of what is quality. Quality to me is... it means it's meaningful. So it's meaningful to that community of children, families and educators. There is a relentless focus on continuous improvement. So that sense that we're always trying to think, what could we do better here? When challenges and compliance issues come up, we don't approach them with a defensive attitude. We think, right, okay, that's an opportunity for improvement.
Mm.
But underlying all of that, so that's my very complicated NQF-based approach to it, is educators. So educators do this work. So how educators are treated and valued by the organisation they work for, how an organisation demonstrates commitment to supporting early childhood educators to undertake the work they undertake, that is all that makes the difference. So it doesn't matter what, posters I'm developing in my office or what marketing we're developing. If educators don't feel supported to do the incredible work they do, then there cannot be quality in early education centres. So to me, it fundamentally comes down to educators and teachers. And I should say I'm using the term educators to include teachers as it does in the early years learning framework.
And student teachers.
And student teachers as well.
Yes.
That's what it comes down to.
Yeah, great. I know you're a close watcher of politics. In fact, I'd say you're a contributor towards policy reforms, Liam, because of your role over time. We won't give away anything about your age. And your understanding of the impacts and reforms that have been undertaken across the sector in Australia's history, I think, is phenomenal. I'm wondering which in particular policy or funding/funding reforms and initiatives you think have had the best or the greatest positive impact on the sector. And I'm thinking, if nothing comes to mind straight away, but I'm sure it will for you, whether you think, for instance, the new version of the Early Years Learning Framework 2.0 is an indication of that. But if you can think of others too, I'm really curious.
It's easier to think of, it's quicker to list positive ways government policy has affected the sector. It's taken a lot longer to list negative ones, Kat, so I like that you've forced me to think of positive ones.
You can talk about a few negative ones. I think that's valuable for students to...
Sure.
Well, they come together, don't they?
Yeah.
We don't do everything right.
Well, I think before I answer that question, it's worth pointing out that sometimes there's a discussion in the sector around, can we just keep politics out of it? Or, politics doesn't have anything to do with the teaching or the provision of early childhood education. And, respectfully, I couldn't disagree more.
So yes, it's not the economy, stupid. It's politics.
It's not the economy, stupid. And, there's a lot of, amazing thinkers and people out there who have, contributed that idea that silence is political too. So not choosing to engage is a political act.
Yes.
The work we do with young children, we know that. So everything we do, from the second we walk into an early childhood centre, the regulations, the curriculum, they've been set by governments. They've been approved, they've been passed in legislation. We talk a lot about the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child in terms of the work we do. That is a political document. It was mm-hmm. signed and ratified by governments and pretty regularly broken by governments as well. Everything we do is political, from you know, how far apart our cots have to be in our infant spaces to the kind of play-based learning we're doing. So the idea that we can just say, I don't want to think about politics, to me, we just can't, because it's political not to engage. You stole my thunder there, Kath. What I would say is that in terms of positive ones, the early years learning framework, both the original, I probably want to talk more about the original because it was such a rarity at the time. I think I'm right in saying that when it was first introduced in its draft form in 2009, we were the only country in the world that had a curriculum, a national curriculum document for the first 5 years.
Even Te Whariki in New Zealand was?
Te Whariki, I think, after? Was, you could be right actually, but I think it might have been around the same time. Or
yeah, I think as we do.
As we do.
We like to pinch.
That's right, yeah, yes, yes, for sure.
New Zealand.
We're very good at that.
So that, but you know, it is internationally renowned.
That's
that.
Right. It was, yeah. And I remember the Canadian academic Ted Malouche talks regularly about that. He spent a lot of his time, I think, over the last decade, trying to take what we do here and take it to Canada, because it is, that's one of the ways, one of the very few ways we were sort of so far ahead from everyone. And as with everything, no document is perfect. Other things, if I was solely tasked with writing the EYLF, would I write it differently? Of course. But the idea that we have a document that is a national standard, is so focused on play, that doesn't include checklists around whether, you know, a child can walk over a balance beam or can say 20 words or can count, you know, to 20. None of that is in the early years learning framework. Mm-hmm. It is entirely based on the research that talks about sociocultural approaches to learning that is based on play.
And the agency of the child.
Exactly right. Yeah. So that, to me, is, you know, a huge policy win for us. And wrapped up in the National Quality Framework, which, again, you know, it's very easy to complain about compliance and the regulatory burden, but the idea that in Australia we can say any child can walk into an early childhood centre across the country and there is a minimum standard for their safety, their well-being, their learning, we can't underestimate that. And again, there are changes we could make and we should all contribute to the reviews and all those kind of things, but that, we shouldn't underestimate what that is.
What we're building on.
That's right. And then for the most recent updates to the EYLF, you know, I'm particularly excited that there is such a stronger emphasis on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander perspectives. They were in the first version of the EYLF, but they're just embedded and weaved quite beautifully throughout. Yeah. And as well as the focus on sustainability. So we know that, you know, we're working with the generation that will inherit, you know, potentially some real challenges that are being left by us. So of course that's an engagement we have to have, where we're you know, hopefully encouraging a more proactive approach to caring for this planet than, unfortunately, probably we've done.
Yes, I agree. And I think it, in interesting ways, the cross-curriculum priorities in the older children, school children's national curriculum match it. Other than the Asian one, but I think we actually may have got there first in the early childhood one. So that means too, Liam, I'm thinking about, I think it was page 13, the questions that have been raised about that child who's silent, who's quiet, you know, the politics of silence, that we actually ask in the document who's missing out or who's not.
Who's advantaged and who's disadvantaged.
Who's advantaged and who's not, and I think that's a really great step forward too,
Yeah, absolutely, I mean, and that, because the embedding of principles in social justice in that work, and we, and again, Australia is a deeply conservative country. If we think about, you know, the treatment of refugees and asylum seekers over the last 10, 15 years, we've only just recently passed marriage equality laws, all that kind of stuff. Australia has as a country, we sort of narrow our eyes a bit in anything to do with social justice and, you know,
we do a fair go for everyone.
Exactly. We're fair dinkum. I'm not quite sure what that means for everyone, but the principles of social justice have embedded in that framework right from when it first started back in 2009, and is, you know, even more strongly called out in the current version. And that's really fantastic, because that means that, you know, learning is political as well, and learning is about context, and that we can really tackle some of the ideas around, you know, for me particularly, our responsibility to discuss and include Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander perspectives, and not just the positives, but also what that means when we know there is a huge gap between the outcomes for non-Indigenous and Indigenous Australians in this country. Early childhood centres, you know, have a role to play in how we address that disadvantage, how we don't look away from challenges. So that's, yeah, the principles of social justice that are right there embedded in the EYLF. And there's no bigger social justice question than who is advantaged or disadvantaged by the way I work.
Yes, that's a classic one, that one. I understand you started out in media studies, you mentioned, and then made the big switch. And I know you've developed a podcast, a popular podcast, The Early Education Show, which I'll provide details of for the students later on so they can follow it up. And that you did that in conversation with expert advocates in the field. So you put that media interest skill to great use. I wanted to ask you what you saw as some of the challenges involving the speed and acceleration of communication technologies in the field. Ooh. And the ethical considerations that students on prac, anyone attending a centre, someone working in a centre or at a school has to think about.
This is one of those questions. It's like, how do we define quality? That we could just spend the whole conversation, because I'm going to try and boil it down. So I think it is really interesting. So I'm going to preface this by saying at Northside, so across our five early education centres, we do not use any documentation apps or anything like that. So no Story Park, no anything.
Pens and paper?
We do have the occasional sort of keyboard and laptop around.
iPad.
But it's for, we try and keep those things out of classrooms. And that's for a very specific reason. And this is one of those things where, you know, I'm fortunate to be in a position of authority and awesome, which means I can kind of have things the way I want them. And I hopefully use that power rarely and only for good. But
yes.
I'm sort of on the record saying that, you know, while I'm at Northside, they will not be there. And there's a few reasons for that. One is there is still such limited research, and the research we do get is quite concerning around the effect of children's exposure to those devices in the first 5 years. Now, I want to be really clear. I'm a parent of children, and they definitely got some screen time, and probably more than the recommended dosage. So it's not about judging particularly parents for that work. There's more than enough judgment of parents out there. But I think educational sector, we have to hold ourselves to a higher standard, and we're going to say the jury is still out on what all this, you know, access to tablets and devices is doing for children and their young developing brains. So that's one reason. The main reason, though, for me is that I actually find it really disrespectful to educators. So these devices are marketed and developed and designed to sort of tell educators how to do documentation. So there's sort of boxes to fill in, and everyone's encouraged, and, you know, all of these things are marketed as this is the solution to your documentation problems, and this is how you meet Quality Area 1 educational program and practice. This is how you engage with the EYLF. I find that really disrespectful to how educators think and they're engaged. Engagement with critical reflection and their engagement with the communities of people they work with. I far more trust educators to do their thinking about what and how they do.
Because we have a long history of being taught to watch and observe that has sort of scientific roots in, the child study.
Yeah.
But sorry, I interrupted. And
third one. Trying to think how many I've got. I might be getting up to four or five. I'll try
and
stop at four.
No, that's fine.
The third thing is, but also what that fundamentally does is those programs, they package up and design that work of educators, so the thinking that educators are doing, and prepare it as I always call it a social media feed for families. So they've got their Facebook, their Instagram, and then this scrolling feed of stuff from centres. So it encourages, for me, really limited and non-meaningful interaction and engagement with families, and it actually reduces the understanding the families have about the thinking that goes in behind that stuff.
Yes.
So we do not engage with any of that stuff, and I am really concerned that the sector has just bought into this wholeheartedly. Mm. These programs and apps have not been around for very long. It is now very difficult to find a centre that does not engage with them. Mm. I have significant questions about who is storing this data. So there's a huge amount of thinking and writing about children. They're probably stored on a cloud server belonging to Amazon or, you know, some huge company somewhere else. I don't think those questions are being discussed by anyone in the sector who owns this information that we're providing about children. And what is it doing to the sector? What are we saying is important about documentation? It's really important for me that we look at, so there are 9 elements in Quality Area 1, Educational Program and Practice. Only really 2 of them are very specific around documentation requirements. We're a bit obsessed with the documentation requirements in the sector. What the rest of that quality area is talking about is the thinking behind what we're planning for children. And yes, how we share that for families. But for me, documentation is not for families. I don't care whether families like it or not. And I'm on the record of saying this at Northside. It makes me very popular, as you can imagine. The purpose of documentation is not for families. The purpose of documentation is for educators to assess children's learning and plan for what they're doing next. So as soon as you make the audience a parent, we start writing things like...
For them.
Yep, we start writing things to that them. Is non-meaningful and is about, you know, that they had a nice birthday party or whatever, and we do all these happy snaps because we think that's what make families. But once we start realising we are the purpose of the documentation and no educator should write anything unless it's helping them do their job, then we're sort of stuck in this phase of the sector where we're devaluing that work and devaluing educators. The thinking and work that, you know, educators do is just incredible. And I fundamentally do not believe that can be reduced to some app that you click on a phone.
That's powerful,
yes.
Liam.
I can't remember the question now, Kath, but I've answered something.
Well, we sort of went from, you know, scary IT to how it's used in the sector. But I think the questions underneath, who are we observing and why, we just have to keep coming back to.
Well, I think I should maybe say there, Kath, I focused on something very specific there, and maybe that's a bit unfair. You know, we should be thinking about how we can incorporate technologies and devices into our work. We know that this is the world children will grow up into. So
So coding and them learning around IT is important.
Safe engagement with devices. Yeah. But there's not a lot of research or evidence for me that says the first 5 years is necessarily the best place to do that. Mm-hmm. And there is actually a lot of research to say is that, you know, the longer you can keep children, you know, engaged in the natural world or particularly if that's actually better for them. So what I always come back to is we just don't know yet.
We don't have the evidence.
Mark Scott used to be the head of the ABC. He now works for University of Sydney. I can't remember, one of the universities. And he wrote this great article a little while ago saying we are in the midst of running this huge experiment on children as a society around access to screens and how that's changing their brains. It is a huge experiment we are running and we don't know what the outcome is yet. Mm. So for me, if I think about how we approach principles of social justice, how we approach principles, who is advantaged or disadvantaged when we work in particular ways, everything we include in our classrooms should come from a place of critical reflection. What is the benefit for children? What are the risks? And how does it professionally represent the work we do?
I sort of see IT as a technology in the same way that writing and reading was a technology. And we know what happens in the Scandinavian schools where children are allowed up until the age of 7 to not engage with those literacy technologies. So your message is really that it's a tool for staff, use it judiciously for yourself and to improve the communication with parents. And don't sort of give in to what being marketed at.
That's right. I would really focus with families that you should be sharing your thinking. And the Early Years Learning Framework makes this really clear, which is around the National Quality Standard. One of the idea is that we should be making learning visible. So that's one of the purposes of documentation.
Yep.
So one of the ways we think about, and we do a sort of monthly newsletter out to families, and it's called Making Learning Visible. So it's not about taking what we do and just sending the bets bits to family. It's about saying this is what we do and why. And so it's about explaining the work we do. So it's families are the audience of that particular one, but it shouldn't be additional work that's being done by educators. So work's happening in classrooms. We want to try and share that with families. And that's a legal requirement under the NQF. Families have access to documentation, but they're not the audience for the. And I think that's a really in some cases controversial view, even mm-hmm. though it's written incredibly clearly in the National Quality Standard. Documentation is for educators to plan for and engage in children's learning, and it can be shared with families. But we think about families as the first audience. It's a big yes. challenge for the sector.
And in fact, documentation can be something that you're teaching children yeah. to do for their own
yes.
thinking. So
yeah.
it becomes, I know, for instance, that children signed themselves in on the yeah. on the forms as they come to
yeah.
your centre. So they get a sense of how documentation yeah. is used to organise thought and
yeah.
and communication
yeah.
amongst us.
Yeah. Far richer and more meaningful than an educator sitting in a room somewhere uploading photos and a comment and sending it to someone's device.
And I think the uploading and the removing yourself to do paperwork can sometimes be a relief from the intensity of engagement.
For sure.
And that there's a little politics that happens in centres between staff about who gets the non-contact time to do documentation.
That's right.
When really it's something that can be ongoing during the...
But also, why is that time necessarily set aside for documentation? So, you know, I've always got to be wary with this kind of stuff. It makes it sound like we're the experts and everything we do is perfect and Northside. It absolutely isn't. We're always thinking about, because there are so many systemic pressures on the sector. So we have exactly the same, you know, challenges that everyone else is facing. But we've always talked about, you know, why is when we have, you know, 2 or 3 hours, you know, programming time, why does that have to be someone sitting at a computer writing someone? Why can't it be conversation with another educator or professional learning or something like that? And that ethically, there's a very strong argument that if you're writing about children, that should be done with and alongside
yes.
children. It shouldn't be done locked away somewhere
yes.
else where we're sort of tapping away and yep. you know, making our judgments
yes.
About children,
yep.
Which is not what educators do. Educators are very good at writing and thinking about that kind of work. That maybe that's time for thinking and discussing as a team and that work is done. The other thing I'll sort of say there, Kath, as well, is that documentation, there's a huge privilege with documentation for those of us who only speak one language, English. Huge amounts of the sector are coming with English as a second language. Some of the most amazing thinkers about children's learning I have ever encountered in my career found the documentation a struggle. I can, get by on one language. We're having people with second, third, fourth languages and expecting them to write this reams of stuff. And that to me is an ethical challenge. Like, what are we, you know, is that the best way we're asking people to? Now, documentation is a requirement, but how we do that is kind of up to us, and we can think of different ways that support people to do that work. But, you know, really, how we position educators in the middle of this is always the big question for me.
Yeah. And would you suggest Reggio Emilia is a good role model with some of its documentation? And
I think there's...
Or is it aged a little?
It's hard to tell. I think,
look,
it's an example. So I think it's very difficult to take something that was so contextual. It's called Reggio Emilia because that's a place. So
It
belongs there. It's also... You know, the funding structure in Reggio Emilia in Italy is very different than we have here. That school's run from, 9 to 3 or something, I think. There's time for educators to gather then and there. I always worry a bit when people set themselves up against Reggio Emilia because the structure we have here, unless you're in a government preschool, is very different. Our centres are open from 7:30 to 6. There's not a lot of time for that kind of stuff to happen. I think, as with everything, you should never take an approach and say, well, we're just going to do Reggio Emilia. We're going to do Reggio Emilia here, or we're going to do Montessori here, or we're going to do whatever. You can take elements of it. Like, what's the underpinning principles of Reggio Emilia of, you know, listening to children and making learning visible in different ways and the 100 languages of children. I think there's amazing stuff there that can be translated to our context. But I always say to people, you know, we should always start with the early years learning framework. That's the national curriculum we have. And we want to make sure we're embedding everything you do there to start with. And I also think, you know, we don't have to go further afield than our own shores. You know, there's the Aboriginal 8 ways of learning, which I don't think we engage in much. Narragunawali from Reconciliation Australia. I would be probably checking out some of those before catching the plane to Italy.
Well said, Liam. As a parent involved in early childhood and primary school systems, because your children are...
Yes.
In both. How do you feel Australia's education systems work together? So we may have students, for instance, who are thinking about, well, I'm doing a prac component in the 3 to 5s, but I'm going to end up with this particular age group. Do you think we've yeah. made any sort of progress there in making schools ready for children in as much as we expect yeah. children to be ready for schools.
Another tricky question, and you've sort of hit the nail on the head, I think, when we talk about school readiness. You know, my view has always been that cliche, which is that means schools need to be ready for children, not the other way around.
How do they do that?
Well, it's interesting.
Is it communication between early childhood educators and school teachers? Is it as simple as that microsystem being strengthened? Or
I'm not sure. I always find it really difficult to get into the detail of this discussion when there's such a power structural imbalance between the schools and the early childhood system. Now, it's not to say that teachers are the most well-off people. Teachers in the primary and secondary school, there are huge reforms that need to happen in that space. Yep. Teachers are clearly not valued enough. It's very difficult as someone who works in the early education sector to not go, there is still such a sizable gap between the work I support every day and the work of schools, even if we just look in terms of conditions and wages. So it's very difficult to have a shared discussion on such unequal footing, and that's a political and social context that needs to be acknowledged, and I don't know if it is enough. What I would say is that I think the school system has a lot to learn from the early education system. When I look at all the research telling us that, children need to be playing more and the play-based education is the best way to go right up through primary school, that's what we do in early education. We are the educators and teachers who work in that space are experts in play-based education. It was a shock to me going from the early education system to, the government school system for both my children. I found it really difficult.
It's a false binary to say intentional teaching and play-based learning
that's right.
don't go together.
No,
they do.
They're both in the early years learning framework.
Yeah.
I think we're missing a trick when, and a lot of this is down to systemic issues for the school system as well, where the Australian curriculum is so sort of, rigid and also at, at the mercy of whatever, breed of politician is in the day. But I wish that, I think there's a lot of, sort of looking at the different parts of the set about what people are doing wrong. I would love for there to be first, an examination of that, the acknowledgement of how important those first 5 years are and the work that the professionals do in that space. And then a sort of coming together about how that could work more effectively. But, school readiness is a really, sort of hot topic because Australia is just continuing to slide down every OECD
chart,
ranking,
yes.
And there's always the questions about data and all that, but it is clear that we're not on the right trajectory. And I think rather than going, well, maybe we need to look at the education system as a whole, including how the early education system fits into that and what are we prioritising as important for children. But I just, and again, it is a huge bias, but I look at the outcomes we're seeking under the early years learning framework. Children are confident and capable communicators and they have a strong sense of identity and all those amazing statements. That to me, it was very difficult going from that to suddenly getting report cards about how,
phonics are going in a certain area or numeracy outcomes.
Yeah.
Kim, I know this is a topic that you and I have talked about to some degree before this interview, but I'm wondering if you can give our students today some insight on how you feel early childhood settings are placed to address gender and other inclusion and equity social justice objectives. But if you'd like to focus on gender, because I know that's your strength, I'd be really happy if you could share some.
Absolutely. Very happy to give the straight white male view on gender and inclusion, Kath, because that we don't get enough of that in society.
I like your response
but,
there, Liam.
Kath, there is no better place to address gender than early education for a variety of reasons. The most at a basic level is we know that gender attitudes are set early.
Mm-hmm.
So all those stereotypes, everything we see, there is research that says that is set by the time children go to school.
The attitudes, not the gender.
No, the attitudes are. But separately for me, coming from a lens of politics, the last early education workforce survey took place last year, or the report came out last year. Mm-hmm. I think it happened during COVID, which is, the dark times, which happened at all different times. 96.3% of the early education sector identify as women. And it is incredibly lowly paid and it is incredibly poorly respected. We still hear politicians getting up in Parliament saying they just wipe noses and wipe bottoms. it is entirely gender-based. So it is because women in our society have done unpaid care work for, you know, generations upon generations upon generations, there is a structural gender inequity that that work is seen not as highly professionalised, skillful education work, but work that's been done by women for free for a long period of time. So it'd be great if those women could stop asking for a bunch more money. It is just, and what's always challenged me about my, so we've sort of talked about that glass escalator effect, and we know that, so 96% of the women, 96% of the sector are women. I can tell you right now, 96% of the CEOs of early education organisations are not women. It's about 50-50 on the last sort of look I did at it. So there's
glad you're keeping tabs.
There's actually a spreadsheet I have that I share with my colleague Lisa Bryan. So I've probably got to update it for a while. You know, the head of Australia's second largest early education organisation, G8, is a man without an early education background. So is, you know, Guardian, all these ones. But what we know, though, is that the effects of what that the pressure that is put on women to do that work, so the effects just spiral out. So we know that women are low paid anyway. So in the early education sector, we know that, you know, women are more, also more likely to face disadvantage and vulnerability outside their work. We know they're going to retire with incredibly low super balances. The disadvantage and vulnerability just spirals out and out and out. And yet, you know, as a man in the sector, Kath, I see far more articles about the amazing, you know, bloke who's working in the sector. And
Isn't he unique and rare?
And how difficult it is for him, Kath. And, you know, I've been asked to join men in early education groups so he can sit around and say how difficult things are for us. And, you know, if people need that, so I shouldn't be too flippant about that. I would never take part in those kind of things. And the reason there is so few men in the sector is not anything to do with how bad things are for men. It is a symptom of the gendered nature of the work and what people think about their work. The numbers of men will increase when we stop chasing men and try and get them into the sector, when we value that work, when we value the work that women undertake in our society. And because I tell you what, you know, men are not staying away from the mining sector where they're getting paid huge amounts. The gender inequities there are, again, as a result of, you know, gendered attitudes. We think bricklayers are worth more in our society than early childhood educators.
So you know what I'm going to ask next.
Different.
What are the practical things a student going out on prac can do to, in the short time they have there, either make, you know, a small difference in some way?
Yeah, well,
is it checking your language? Is it the sorts of things you're looking for? Is it?
Yeah, it's an interesting. I think it's acknowledging it, and I think what I do see sometimes is, you know, is the sort of the idolization of the one man who might be in the, and I think that needs to stop, because I think that always worries me. It's like this: we know we need more men in the sector, and that's true from a general diversity perspective, but it also, to me, it's always implied that maybe women are missing something. That you know, the professionals who are doing this amazing work are missing something that we need to get a bloke in to come and sort out. So we need more diversity in the sector, full stop. And gender, to me, is the least of those, the least of those issues. What I would suggest is, you know, that we do think about language. We think, I always encourage people to just be relentless in their prosecution of the professionalism of the sector. So not saying daycare workers, not saying childcare workers.
Cheaper childcare.
That's a whole other discussion. But this is professional work, acknowledging the professionalism of the work that people are doing in that space. And look, and if you're planning on making a career in early education, join the union. I've been a union member, you know, for a very, very long time. Change is slow, and you know, it is a really difficult, you know, social progress we're trying to make here, but joining the union for me is a fantastic way of being part of that big change.
Great platform, yes, for collective action.
Yes.
Thank you, Liam, for coming in today, taking time out of your busy workload on the escalator and talking to us about some contentious political but heartfelt, passion-driven aspects of working in the field. I'm sure you will have encouraged the students on prac to put that passion first and think about what they're doing and why. Keep that question at the top of their head. I'd also like to thank Joe, our cameraman, and I hope I get to meet with both of you again. So thank you for listening today.